I'm kind of glad I'm in the room today. I'm going to talk with people about doing Dr. Twitter to be interested for the first sentence, and then it's okay. So, yeah, thank you for that. I suppose I probably should introduce myself a little bit. I come from an education background. I suppose I come from two streams. Education's been part of my life since I started in grade preps in various forms, mostly formal education settings, working in schools, working in health, New South Wales Health as a sexual health educator, working in TAFE settings, teaching visual arts. Predominantly my bend is visual arts, that's the area I come from. Also been involved in community projects. I've lived in regional Victoria since 1984, 85. I've lived in Gippsland for a few years. My first teaching position was at Murray High School. So I taught HSC art for the first year at Murray High School, which was learnt by trial by fire, and I survived. I moved to the northeast of Victoria in about 1998, and I've lived in northeast Victoria since then. I live in Beechworth, which people might be aware of Beechworth. It's about 30 kilometres, a bit of a triangle from Albury-Wodonga and Wangaratta. Beautiful part of the world. I choose to live where I do because it's beautiful, but it limits what I can do as far as my vocation and my occupation goes. I think I've taken the line. I don't think I want to be a career academic. After being in the art world and academia, there are so many parallels, but academia is even more uglier, more cutthroat, and it's a world that I don't think I would like to be dictated by. That's sort of my perception, I think. I like doing what I'm doing, but I don't want to pursue it as a career path. I don't think there's lots of things that I'll talk about later on. I've been involved in Regional Arts Victoria. As I said, I've been involved in some community arts-based projects. My doctorate came out of several goes of having a go and thinking, what it is I want to do, what's the question I want to answer. It's always the hard part. I wanted to go initially down a path. I applied through Monash to do a visual arts PhD there, which was predominantly an exhibition and an exegesis, so I explored some of those, and I thought, no, I don't want to go down that path. I want to actually try another path. So I applied for my doctorate and a Doctor of Education. I have an EdD, which is a professional doctorate. It's a little bit different to a PhD. Mine involves a couple of coursework subjects and then a major thesis of 50,000 words. It emanated out of a project I was fortunate enough in 1993 to get a Churchill Fellowship. And I spent 3 months in Scandinavia and Scotland looking at, in particularly in regional communities, how artists impacted on those small communities. What did artists do? How did they operate? So that was sort of a genesis in their thinking. Rather than, and then starting to look at the literature, and I'll go there in a minute as to why I've come up with the topic, but my focus basically is on, when I talk about this, I'm talking about the dialogues of identity and learning that happens for artists in these processes. The whole emphasis for mine was, after being on so many boards and having to justify the existence of art, as far as I'm concerned, the evidence is there that it's powerful, it does amazing things in a lot of contexts, whether it's education, social capital, economic capital, whatever we want to talk about. Looking for a gap for me, looking at all the evidence that was there wasn't much evidence or wasn't many stories there for why did these artists do it and how did it impact on them and shape their identity. So that's the area that I wanted to explore. I took a fairly conventional path, and I'll talk a bit more about that. It was based on a series of semi-structured interviews. Some comments I just wrote here that, it's a lonely path, and I didn't want to, thinking about entering academia, I realised at some point, someone told me, doing a PhD, it's just the gate opens for you. It's not rocket science. It's the things, the tasks you get through that then they'll say, you are an academic. So it's like I was working out the path of least resistance to get through the gate. So trying to work a conventional PhD in some ways or document, and my thoughts was once I'm through the gate, then I can be disruptive. So that was the line I basically took over to that. But that's changed as I started the process, and that'll become evident in what I say. It is, I suppose, about a community of scholars, people are, I remember going to a session, I've got one handout here, getting through your PhD, and the line that was given to me that really stuck in my head was, it is 5% intelligence and 95% hard work. And the 5% intelligence you've got because you've been accepted to do it, it is basically get your head down, get on with it, and be thorough, methodical and scholarly about what you do. Basically, that's the process. It's just a long, hard road. I don't know, would you agree or not? Or
I'll keep that.
Yeah, all right. So I'll ramble a bit. As I said, the title that's there is the title of what my thesis was. That title actually came to me, I think it was finally 2 days before I had to hand in my intention to submit form. So the title changed over the 5.5 years that I getting it close, it was always honing, but I never, like, coming up with the penultimate question to start this journey never happened. It was always, like, I found during the process, it's continually honing. And I suppose one of the things I picked up with what Kim said, she's going to write her thesis tomorrow, I suppose I came from the premise, the day I started my PhD or doctorate was the day I started writing my thesis. It's an integral process of writing along. It's not doing the research and then doing the writing up. It's the way I operate with mine anyway. As I said, I don't think I'm going to be here to give any absolute or definitive. It's going to be a bit of a rambling journey. But I think if there's some stuff around the areas that I actually looked at, I wanted to spend some time talking about how I came from trying to think about working my theoretical framework that I developed. I decided what I wanted to be liberated by is actually not work from one school of thought. I actually used some sociological perspectives, some social psychology perspectives. I actually also used some postmodern theories as well and braided those together in various form. I didn't want to actually have a purist sort of theoretical framework. I've developed up a hybrid of my own to work with. That's about it to start with, I think. And please, I think I'm happy to go with questions as we go. Like, if people are happy with that, and if it's a question that I say I'll answer a little bit later, I'll sort of do it that way, I think, but just so I don't miss it from whatever I'm just trying to work out. So I think what I'll do is I will follow the pattern I want to go through and jump all over the place, identify where I went to, give you somewhat sense about my starting point, my rationale, pretty much how I structured my thesis, looking at some of the areas I explored in my literature review. I can then go to my findings if people wanted to and then come back to the methodology, or I can do the methodology and then the findings. So I'll play with that. What would people prefer?
Well, we do have quite a few people who have got methodological issues of one kind or another. Bo needs to know how to do one, I think. Is that right?
Yeah,
me.
I'm giving you this.
And look, I suppose the findings.
The next generation of methodology.
Sure.
And George has finished her chapter or starting it?
I'll just hand it in.
Okay, yeah. So
we've got some experts among us.
Right, okay. All right, look, sorry. I hope you can see it up at the end there. Some of those slides are a bit dense, but I still haven't got the habit of doing it. I suppose the other thing I need to talk about is who I am at the moment, or one part of my life at the moment. I work for La Trobe University at the Albury Wodonga campus in the Faculty of Education. I work up until yesterday, I was working full time. I'm back to 0.5. I have been coordinating a pre-service teacher education program, so my head is still sort of in that formal teacher education area, but with an emphasis on community education, and the emphasis of my thesis, as you would see, is about learning. So that's where I come from that educative perspective. This was a starting point for me using Rumi's cartoon. It appeared in the start of my thesis, and I used this as a premise to talk about. Has anyone come across the works of Deleuze and Guattari? Deleuze's work talks about concepts of rhizomes and maps, and I used this to say this is a map for my thesis. It's the starting point. And it's basically saying, I started to premise this is, Luna's cartoon actually says to me, artists leaving the world of art, what goodies do they have? Where are they going when they leave that? So I was looking at leaving the world of art, I was seeing that world of art as being the conventional Bourdieuian notion of an art world. Moving into community-based arts practices might be beyond the art world. and seeing some of these things of what footprints do they have and what sort of goodies they have. So it became, I problematised it from the start. This appeared on the front page of my thesis, which was a bit of a glue initially my supervisors away. You can't start your thesis with a moving cartoon. You know, it needs to be a quote. It could be a quote, but not a cartoon. But we, the other thing I soon learned is there comes a point with thesis writing where you listen to your supervisors really carefully, and there comes a point where it shifts, changes, and you actually tell the supervisors what you want to do with your thesis because it becomes your thesis. And I think that's a really important thing. Is the only person who knows that your thesis is you. The supervisors might know it very well, but you know it the best of all. And there comes a point where you should be able to challenge your supervisors and say, but I want to do this because of. And they were the most wonderful debates I had with my supervisors. And once I could mount an argument, they were happy. I could mount an argument and justify why, which is what
they did. Did you have a team from the faculty of education?
So, yeah, that's basically where I started from. As I said, using Deleuze and Guattari's notion is when I talk about a map, they talked about a map is open and connectable in all its dimensions. It's detachable, reversible, and susceptible to constant modification. And that's what I kept seeing. But this acted as a map, and it had multiple entryways as opposed to a tracing, which always comes back to the same. So it's actually saying this map is the starting point, it's not going to lead me through, but I'm going to tear it apart, put it back together, pull apart what all these things are about. That was my way in. And I prefaced this, I suppose, by suggesting that this cartoon had been on my fridge for something like 5 years. So it's something I looked at every day, and I wasn't sure why I had it on my fridge until I started my PhD, and then it became clear. So it's those wonderful things, the connections you make along the way. My rationale for what I did with my PhD was, and I imagine most people would be aware, maybe aware of McCarthy's work, it's, you know, The Gift of the Muse, the famous study from the UK, the US. But they talked about that the notion is the use of community-based arts practice in its various forms is becoming so pervasive that it's everywhere to deal with every social problem, that we socio-economic problem that exists. But we still have to continue to justify it in various ways. I just felt I got sick of reading. I wasn't going to do another bit of another study that justified the value of the arts. I think there's enough there, and I'm not diminishing what you guys are doing, but there's some good work happening in that. I wanted to go a different track here. So I looked at, within the studies that were happening and the discussions that were happening on government reports, the artists' voices were pretty much silent. Or if the voices were there, they were talking about the learnings. They talked about the learnings of others. You know, that this person did this thing, and that was amazing. But we would never get into hearing why they were doing it. So for me, this was the gap, and I suppose that's where was always talked about with me, is when you're doing a substantial piece of study, you're looking for gaps in the literature, and that's where you actually sort of try and find a pathway to take to study. So for me, that's where I decided I wanted to go. I'll deal with that there. So to me, my initial proposition, and I suppose what I wanted to talk about there is, you know, these are stuff I learned along the way that I soon discovered that possibly working from this perspective, writing a PhD or a doctorate or a thesis, you either come from a hypothesis or a proposition or there's assumptions made, and you need to frame those propositions or a hypothesis. If you're following a conventional scientific sort of thesis, it might well be a hypothesis if you're trying to test something and prove something, but you can also work from propositions. So the proposition I was working from is when they assumption, and it's also assumption I suppose I was making, and if that happens. So it's not so much, mine was not framed as a question to answer, it was about an inquiry. So there was again another emphasis to me that I didn't have a specific question that I wanted to answer, and I'll talk about some of that a bit later on. I got continually caught between being innovative and alternative and wanting to do things, but I talked about that before, that in the end I decided, you know, I think I'm going to take a little bit of a safe path here in putting my thesis together into how I construct it and build my document. But as I said, more possibilities are developed by me. The literature, they were the sort of key areas that I started to look at. I sort of went back to my proposition or what I was looking at and thinking, I have a key words or key concepts that I'm going to look at. So my literature review section became quite extensive, and I had to problematise all of those concepts in various ways because they weren't necessarily easy concepts in their own right to start to think about. That's a fairly big slide, but I suppose what I want to talk about there, my prompts for questions to guide the study, the key aspects that I came back to was thinking about the artists, so I was talking about identities, and I was talking about the practices they do, which is working in community-based practice, and I posed these as sort of sub-questions to, when I'm looking at the literature, these are the sorts of things that I'd be looking for when I come to probably gather my data, which might be, at that point I still wasn't sure, but I was coming to the conclusion that it probably would be conversational. It might include some art-based stuff that if it was useful, but I wasn't sure about that. So they were the sort of concepts that I was thinking about. I hope you can read those off the back.
I have a question.
Yep.
And when you're saying it, sounds like it's quite really obvious. Oh, this is a bit controversial, I'll leave it aside.
Mm-hmm.
I'll go with this because it's safer. I was wondering, what would you do if you're coming along and you think, oh yeah, this is it, oh, I'm finding this and there's a hole in this, and really interesting.
Yeah.
How did you
start?
Oh, they're not touched.
No, what I'm talking about is the structural arrangement of my thesis. It had an introduction, a literature review, a methodology chapter, and a findings chapter.
I'm not
talking about content at all, no. No, it's the structural format of having a nice conventional thesis with chapter 1, chapter 2, chapter 3. Whereas, you know, there are many options now of how you present a thesis as well, which is possible. Like that sort of can be a, you know, that's one too. I know at La Trobe there was a huge issue where I think it was usually found portrait, that format. A thesis was down one side and presented like that. That's a huge outcry. How can you present a thesis that's found down the side? It doesn't fit on the library shelf neatly that way. So the conventions around even the document that you produce, and so to me it was a structural thing. Yeah. So sorry about that. So they were the key sorts of questions that I kept coming back to, and I think that was for me, these were some sole points that I kept, okay, come back to these, why am I doing here, what am I reading, is it answering, helping me answer these sorts of questions or not in that literature review, because I think everyone in the literature review, it's a fantastic time, you can go on the most amazing journeys. And you think, well, how did I get here? And why am I reading this? And why should I be reading this? Does it relate to my question or what I wanted to do? So my final proposition came back to these statements, and I had to pluralise things. I had to come back to community-based arts practices and talk about identities rather than a single identity and talking about a single community-based practice or community-based arts. The more I started to read, the more they became, no, they don't exist. I can't talk about a one definitive notion there. So that's the problem. Initially they became problems. Well, I've got to find one definition of community arts, and I've got to find it. And then you'll say, no, it's not. There's many, and live with the many, I suppose.
Did you spend much time choosing the term community-based?
Yes. Yep, and I'll talk about that as to why I started with community arts, I think, is the initial phrase I was using, and then that became, as I said, really problematic. So that's why, that's the phrase I finished up using to base my study on, community-based arts practices, because some of the artists have not seen themselves as community artists, but they worked with communities. Okay? It's an interesting thing in itself, so we have to work with what they are. And so my intentions in the end were to gain a sense of what the ways the artists who undertook the community-based practices perceived themselves, the work they did, why they did the work, and explore the learning. And I suppose that was a key aspect for me, the learning that occurs for them when they find themselves in those contexts. So my aim in the end, and this is, you know, I'm trying to distill how I got to my questions, I suppose, and what I wanted to do, to consider how working as a community-based artist may influence their ways of thinking, how they make meaning or learn from the situations in which they find themselves, and how that in turn shapes them. Okay, I was with them on a proposition that it would, but I also prefaced this by saying it may. I wasn't sure whether it would or not. I wasn't going in there, I was working on a proposition, but I was only going to find that out by talking to these artists. So, again, I suppose it's the thing I learned is being scholarly, methodical, explaining what you're doing is key aspects. So, who is the artist? Problems. I haven't sourced these fairly well, but I started this slide late one night. I haven't got the citations for this, but I have on the others. Going through various government documents, the works of whose reports do I look at here? Throsby's studies. Everyone would be aware of Throsby from Wollongong University. He's done a study every 10 years or 12 years about the status of arts in Australian artists. Looking at that, so his study, Meyer's study from Sutton about 1994, or Dewin's work, and talking about the different labels that are used within government departments, depending on for taxation, you're an artist if you've got certain criteria to getting, a public health card to be entitled to employment benefits, various different criteria in different even arms of government that allows to say if you're an artist or not. The qualifications and credentials, so the formal and informal, you know. Are you only an artist if you've done a tertiary degree, you know? Who knows? That's one criteria that's used for any other profession, doctors, lawyers, everyone else. There's a credentialed process you go through. Some do, some don't. I wasn't going to be of the opinion to say, well, I'm only going to look at artists that have done this, but it problematises how we look at artists. Again, that sort of perspective that, you know, an artist can be someone that usually that's not their main source of income. Bord Dewin talks a lot about that, you know, most artists will have their prime source of income comes from something else, whether it's washing dishes or being a teacher or whatever. So, yeah, again, sometimes our identity and who we are in our profession is dictated by how we earn our income. Artists would identify themselves as an artist, but it's not necessarily how they earn their living. The work of Meyer from their studies into the visual arts, the notion of artists, he was talking that about a lot of artists starting to call themselves artists rather than painters or sculptors or dancers, or they're starting to use this label. I was reading literature that talked about that artists potentially maybe had more kudos than the way they practiced. But another argument, line that was being used is now so many artists don't necessarily work in one modality. Maybe not necessarily painters, they might be mixed approaches, so those sorts of things. And then the other categories that are there, that, you know, the artist is usually seen as other, outsider, and usually either one end of the spectrum or the other. They're the genius or the lunatic. They're nowhere in the middle. So they're always potentially just the other in some way, they're special in some way. And there's a link there to Sozy. Because it was one of the things that mightn't be as great as I want it to be, but it's a model that Bourdieu, is anyone familiar with working for Bourdieu?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? It's Bourdieu's model of, the three states of the field. So he talks about, you know, cultural capital and economic capital of artists in the field of power. It was a model that started to make, it was one of those aha moments for me. There's a framework here, I might be able to start to build my study around, and it sort of talks about that we can have cultural capital and economic capital, and we can have cultural capital and cultural economic capital over this side. We have, it's diminished cultural capital, but it's high economic capital, so things like in the field of power, the non-professional cultural producers. But in this area, you can have lots of cultural capital, but not much income or not much economic kudos in relation to that. And sliding up and down, that we're talking about the consecrated avant-garde artists, so the artists who are the celebrity artists. And we're working in a model here where we might have the bohemian outsider artists within the model. So it gave me a framework to work in. That's all I want to. I don't want to get too bogged down in it, but it was a model that I came across that is different. Okay, so that was the artist dealing with the problems of the artist. And I came across, and that comment from Ching was a really nice one that I actually used to, again, identify why there was a problem. It's one of the professions, you know, it wants to duck and weave. As soon as you try to label it, it will move to somewhere else.
the work of, and I've brought sort of two key texts that I don't know whether people want to look at, but this one by Kester, Conversation Pieces, Community Communication and Modern Art, was another text that I, was when I started to read this one, so there were some structures in it, I thought, yes, this is nice, it's making some sense for me. And Kester had in this text had these couple of diagrams of Willett's work to talk about how a usual conventional notion of an artist is perceived. So the artist is here, the artwork in the middle and the audience, and potentially there's no interaction between the audience and the artist. It happens through the artwork. And so it was another model. I found myself, and it was one of the things my supervisors kept saying to me, Mark, do you like diagrams? You could show things in drawings rather than writing. I kept coming up with models and diagrams and charts. And for me, again, from my perspective, I'm a practitioner who works in the arts, it was sort of coming through even though I was trying to stop it. And they let me go with it, which was great. So that was one model that I looked at compared to Willett's model, which is that one that talks about the socially interactive model of arts practice, where the artwork becomes in the centre, and we talk about the context, the artist and the audience, and how the three or four interact end to end. And so for me, again, this became another little piece of my jigsaw puzzle, another little bit to be thinking about, okay, when I'm working with community-based artists and listening to their stories, of these two models, which one might apply to them? So when I'm starting to think about those sorts of structures.
Okay.
Now, community-based practices, there we go. In my search for literature, I came across community arts, you know, Hawkins' work, community cultural development, came across the title New Genre, Public Art from the US, Social Sculpture, Dialogical Art, Making in Communities, Relational Art, Socially Engaged Art, Participatory Art, Socially Engaged Participatory Art. All of them were sort of what I was looking at, but none of them in particular. I couldn't say I was looking at this one. But they all sort of had intimations and tokens and sort of references to the work that I was looking at. So for me, I went from using this term to this talking about community-based practices, suggesting all of these were practices that were based in communities somehow.
So no one else has used this exact term that you have seen?
Which?
Community-based arts practice.
I think the term community-based practice, this was, that came from another model that I found here by Doherty's work. And he talked about, Cleveland, sorry, I think he talked about arts-based community development.
Mm-hmm. That's the language for arts funding in Canada, community-based.
Yeah. So for me it was a mixture of putting those things together. I couldn't find anywhere, the term community-based arts practice might have existed, but the S on the end was for me, because I was working across so many, it allowed me to pluralise it.
Probably some overlap with policy language and just speaking
policy
language.
Yeah.
Where's the Centre for Creative Communities? I think that was England, isn't it?
England, yeah, it's finished now. Yeah. And Rhys and Pringle's work became a key one for me. Pringle did a study called We Did Stir Them Up, which was was based on their creative practitioner project in the UK, where they put artists into various sites of learning. And she followed up and did interviews with them again about, but the emphasis with that was about what their role was in the site, not what about that actually learned. So I'll leave that at that. The next key concept that came up for me was, so literally these became sections within my literature review. Identities, again I'm pluralising that in relation to the concept about what's the difference between self and identity, is identity developed or does it form, is it static or fluid? And the concepts, these are some of the structures I work in, so to assist me to make some sense of that. So even Bourdieu's notions of habitus and field, Paul's concepts about the enlightened self, the sociological self and the postmodern subject, Giddens' structure agency argument. Cody and Levine's identity capital, which is a pretty much a social psychology model was the one that I sort of started to warm with in what I was doing, and also Deleuze and Guattari's notions around becoming, rhizomes and folds, found to make some sense for me in how I was starting to put things into place. With a lot of this work, I tended to come up with the notion that identities are mediated by the subjective and the objective world, if we want to talk about them as such. So I came up with, and I think this will, that's bad if you're wrong, but I think I've hot linked it to make it a bigger version, if we do the right thing. I start again to make some sense of all what all these theorists were saying. I needed to map it out for myself in this process, and we're talking about that the individual world, I suppose, being here with various theorists talking about it as different concepts, that social interaction world, and then the social or the cultural world, and using House's model of the personality and social structure became for me to start to think about, okay, the theoretical frameworks I'm working inside here are that when artists learn, they're going into social spaces, so if their identities are starting to be socially mediated as a result of being in those spaces. So this is the framework that allowed me to build some of that stuff. And again, just exploring some of that. Okay. The next area is learning. So again, that concept of experiential-based learning from Dewing perspectives and Kolb and Rogers and Friedberg's concepts. And looking at the concept of Jarvis is, you know, people talk about experiential based learning, but again, that's really problematic in the fact that it can be seen as a doing thing, whereas Jarvis would actually maintain that any learning is by experience. We're having one here, even though we're sitting in very passive. So coming up with those various notions about what experience is, coming up with the concepts around that learning happens when disjunctures occur for us, or can be a transformative process where there's a shift happens in how we think from one place to another, and looking at, again, Deleuze and Guattari's notions there of plateaus and folds, Jarvis's and Nesero's concepts of transformative learning. And then building up those sorts of things about thinking learning is a formal thing or an informal thing or a non-formal thing or a conscious or an unconscious notion about how learning occurs, and where we learn, what sites do we learn and or situations do we learn in. So that also became another key aspect to be thinking about learning. Wenger's and Berunder's and Senge's notions of social theories of learning and communities of practice were considered, and also the concepts of Borman's and Turner's work about communitas and societas. Has anyone come across those key concepts? They started to really help me make some sense around how learning can happen in various places. And also the other key parts was the notion of lifelong or life-wide learning. Obviously key things, lifelong has been talked about for some time, but I was actually talking about artists here with wide experiences. So our life is not getting any longer than it has been, well, probably getting a little bit longer every generation because of drugs and whatever, and our healthy living, but also our lives are becoming broader in many ways too over the span of our lives. So it's not only that, it's that. One of the models that this was, are people familiar with Kolb's experiential based learning model? It's a model that's used fairly regularly to talk about how learning occurs, but it usually happens at one of those points where we might have a concrete experience, get some reflective observation happen, and then there might be an abstract conceptualization, then maybe some active experiments, and then the process starts again. It's quite a common model in particularly for adults, because I suppose what I'm looking at is theories about adult learning, working with artists. It's a model that's used for adult learning. It also gets canned very much, which it should be, as it's too simplistic a model. The model that I started to look at was another model by Jarvis, who talks
about this, and this helped me to actually make some sense about how I was working. But when we're talking about learning, what we're seeing is a person who's learning can be the body, the mind, the self, and life history, our biography, what we bring to those situations. And we're in our world. We have an episode that there can either be an emotion, and we can move on and we've changed. There might be a thought or a reflection and we move on, or there might be an action, or there might be... I suppose what this model is saying is we don't have to have all of these for some change to occur in us. Okay, whereas the previous model, which I don't know whether I can go back with this, yes, is saying this has to happen every time. Whereas this model is actually saying this could happen, this could happen, this could happen. So again, saying learning, again, there's no complete theory on learning. We still don't have a complete theory of learning. And good, thank goodness we don't. And how individuals learn and how humans learn. And this was the quote that stuck with me from Jarvis. Learning is the combination of process throughout a lifetime whereby the whole person, body, so it's genetic, physical and biological, and mind, knowledge, skills, attitudes, values, emotions, beliefs and senses, experiences, social situations, the perceived content of which is then transformed cognitively, emotionally and practically, or through a combination, and integrated into an individual person's biography, resulting in continually changing, more experienced person. That's Jarvis's concept of learning. Okay, what do artists do when they go into sites of learning? This is some of the literature that I was reading. Sometimes I pick up one of these and go, they've got my thesis. You know, you start to go down the path and think, no one's done it. And then you find an article or you find a book, yes, someone's done it. And you go, no, there's bits in it that's still not mine, what I want to do. So the works of, again, you know, they acquire new labels and identities with the creative projects that happened in the UK with the Blair government that built on Creative Communities, I think it was. I've been out of my PhD now for, I graduated this time last year, so it's become, this time last year I would have been able to have said all this off the top of my head, it's becoming a distant memory. I need to refer to notes now and notes, you know, you move on a little bit. But the word creative practitioners started to appear, so they lost the word of being artists and became creative practitioners. And the concept of being teaching artists has also emerged in the States, and I think it's crept into various concepts here in Australia as well. They perform a number of roles. Lacey talked about them being experienced as reporters, analysts and activists. Pringle's work talked about being educators, role models, collaborators, social activists, researchers, inquirers. Rita Irwin's another one, which is a book I came to or an understanding later in my life as being an EdD student. And if I hadn't discovered this one pretty early, I think I would have gone for it, the concept of artography. Has anyone heard of this? The artography, and I'll talk a little bit more about that in a little bit. But Irwin comes from Canada. He comes from Canada, you know, British Columbia. And the artographer, it stands for being an artist, teacher and researcher. So it's artist, researcher and teacher-ographer. So it's saying the three are together. You work together as three. You're not one or the other. There's bits and parts that work together. It's interesting. It's probably a bit left of field. It's gained some traction in Canada. But it's still not common elsewhere. Has everyone seen Lacey's model as well? I can't open that one. Okay. Oh, maybe something in an old version.
Lacey's just undertaking her PhD right now, too.
Is she?
Yeah, she's written a lot of books about this.
Yeah. Beforehand. Yeah. She's been around for a long time. This is work from 1995. And Lacey uses this model of artists, potentially the private world and the public world, and artists being experiences where it's purely subjective, and they can potentially move through this continuum or move along a continuum to being reporters, where they start to go beyond reflecting to an artist that actually analyses, and they talk about being, you know, investigative journalists or social scientists, moving up to being basically a social activist of various sorts. So it was again another model, and again you can see it was in a nice graph and a chart, so I liked it. For me, be able to make sense of, rather than reading pages and pages, I would get lost. For me, in those graphs and charts, it would help me in understanding the process. So, but Lacey's with another structure that I could come back to and use. And they would facilitate learning by dialogical rather than cued elicitations or directives, and they would extend rather than change pupils' initial ideas. This is some studies that came out of watching artists working with kids in schools compared to teachers. So it was actually saying that teachers potentially work on ways where artists will go in and start conversations with kids, and the learning will happen, whereas teachers will start to work on rather than a cued elicitation or a directive, do this, or don't come in like that, do this, whereas the artist would go, why are you coming in like that? Various different approaches, or extend those ideas, yeah. Because this, again, you know, the arts is going to be the answer to how teachers might teach better, because artists do it so well with people, why can't teachers? I gave a couple of weeks ago at an art education conference where we talked about some of my findings where, yes, artists do amazing work in schools, but they don't have to deal with a lot of the other things that teachers have to deal with in schools. That sort of probably limits why teachers can only do certain amounts. And the notion of partnership, and I put this partnership here, I could have also put that back in the previous slide about notions of community-based arts practices. That from my reading is, you know, I'm not sure now that I've been out of it a little bit, whether community cultural development is still the language used, or is it about arts partnerships? Arts partnerships seem to be another language that's emerged quite much more recently, about partnerships with communities and whatever else, and funding bodies use it.
Another question.
Yeah.
You're talking about the approach of artists in schools,
It's about working in system. I think, and that is, I'll come to that in one of my findings.
But in some ways, they can't be operating at the same time.
They can to a certain extent, but then the teacher will have to compromise certain bits to get those outcomes or meet certain deadlines or whatever else.
So, power
relationship. Sure. It could be about power as well. There's a whole lot of factors in there. Again, you know, all I can, and again, what I want to say with this is my findings is based on conversations with 12 artists. So they are not definitive. They are not, you know, they're not absolute truths. Perceptions of truth. Look, it's too complex. As I said, I think the issue is that you're asking teachers to do amazing, wonderful things, and they are doing them. But I think it's also tied to some times where there's outcomes-based learning, and kids are being tested continually, and the amount of time that's there is not there. So it's a hard road. And I'll talk about it with a couple of the artists that I actually interviewed. Some of them, I'll get there, but I'll come back to it if I don't, okay?
But some artists, I think this is the whole thing. I think there's a broad range of artists that are expected.
Sure, yes.
And I think when artists start with people, and that they teach them things, they have to find answers. Unlike as you started, it's not just an artist, you start with proposition, and then it's a piece of proposition.
Yep.
So people, depending on their personalities, work in, you know, from both ways.
Exactly.
And I don't think it's to do with the role, but to do with the
person. Exactly.
Kind of relationship.
Yep. Oh, sure. But also, similarly, how artists have the identity of an artist, a teacher can have the identity of a teacher. So it can actually, the social construction of what a teacher is can actually inform other people's views of what they do as well. And you start to talk about all teachers being like this, and the same way we talk about all artists, and we know that, you know, so there's some contradictions there. This was my conceptual framework in the end. Again, I came up with a nice graph or a nice model to work under, and it was worth it. This, my work was based on, and I'm just trying to remember their name. Sorry to do this, I should know it off the top of my head. I can't go there. No, I'll come back to it. It's called, and the text is in my reference list, it's sort of analysing a qualitative work, and it talked about getting your theoretical framework down to a page. And the structure to actually develop up a theoretical framework is you should be able to hone it back to a page to talk about it. If it's too complex, it's not going to work. So try and really kind of hone it down. And if you can do it diagrammatically, it's probably even better. And when I said, oh, is that when someone's encouraging me? According to... So I could do it. And it's basically, it's a model that's based on... it's based on Wendt's notion of a social theory of learning. And if I talk about it, we can actually almost run a line through the centre of this and actually say the bottom part here is our subjective internal world, and the stuff on this side is the objective world outside, if that makes sense. So this is bits about me. These bits here are about the social structures in our world, whatever else, yeah? And then there's a bit that runs through the middle, which is where the two bits collide. So it's sort of a bit social interactive. Again, going back to that model that I showed you of how we are perceived, partly by how others perceive us and when we interact with one another. And I could see it rather than being... I started to use this diagram because I started to talk about Deleuze's notions of plateaus. Has anyone... sort of Deleuze talks about plateaus. Plateaus occur when we have an experience. So we have an experience and we... it's a heightened experience, but it's not a climax. And then we absorb the experience and we move on. And we have a series of plateaus over our life. And that plateau we absorb and we take on and move on. My argument is using this cylindrical notion rather than circular. I wanted to point out that these will grow and move depending on who we are and how we are. So depending on the situated experience, it could be bigger or whatever else. I was trying to make it... If I was submitting my thesis digitally, I would have made this a flash version, so I would make these be able to interact and move them up and down. So to say that at any one time, that's what I got down to the level of mind, saying if I represent these as a flat circular notion, it's essentially almost representing that everything is equal in how a person, what affects a person's learning and how they interact. I'm wanting to suggest that different times, different parts will have a different place. Okay. Okay, so we're sort of getting into the methodological stuff here.
Yeah.
Cool. Well, from my perspective, that's how I kept thinking, is at the end of the literature review, that's the time where I start to develop my theoretical framework. I've read all the literature, this is what's going to inform how I then go next. That's how I sort of started to structure my thesis. So, research approach. Just quickly, 12 artists. I looked at 12 artists who lived in regional Australia. Again, I really wanted to, when I came back to saying, oh, Jesus, some people who have done some of this, they had done stuff, but predominantly had been with people in large, it was mainly Northern Hemisphere, and if it was studies, it was done with people in large centres, capital cities, big metropolitan centres, not in regional areas. My emphasis was on regional artists. So looking at 12 regional artists, I talked about, potentially I had an emphasis on looking at visual artists, for want of a better word. Again, another premise I was working on is visual artists tend to be potentially loners in what they do, their practice. Maybe either if you're a performer or a musician, there's potentially that you might be interacting with someone else to make art because of the nature of the art form. and because I'm a visual artist as well, and I suppose it's again declaring that I'm in this research. This research is nowhere known as it objective, and I suppose most of you will be aware that probably none of yours would have been either, or is. If it is, you're kidding yourself. I learned that pretty quickly too. The participants were referred by cultural workers, so I set up a process where rather than me identifying mate and interviewing to keep at some level of subjectivity or distance, I used a network of cultural workers. I sent them a word picture in the form of a criteria. This is the criteria I want to assess, I want to interview people by. They let me know they could identify people. What I did was send them X amount of information packages that they forwarded on to the potential participants, and then the potential participant rang me. So it's that process. I didn't have direct contact to them. The culture workers acted as for want of a better word, a gatekeeper or a conduit. So what I was getting was asked to, and the criteria that I used, they needed to live and work in regional Australia, Southeast Australia. They could have either a formal arts background or not. So I didn't care if they were arts, had an arts qualification or not, depending if they were seen as an art and practicing as an artist. Ideally, I wanted them not to have had an education background. I didn't want them to be teacher educators. But that was one of the things that I needed to backtrack on a bit, because a few of the cultural workers said, you know, the pool of artists we have around here, there's lots, but all of them have been teachers in a previous life or done what, and in the end I said, well, that was an ideal, I'll still interview them, but I'll modify my study as a result of that, which that drew up some interesting stuff, how people who had been teachers and artists talked about the role of a teacher and the role of an artist when it came to being in schools. That was an interesting little bit of data that came up. And I used semi-structured interviews. I travelled to each of the sites, so I went over to the south coast of New South Wales, central Victoria, right through to the south, to across to Ballarat. My ethics, I haven't used them here, is their last names. These names are their names. With my ethics approval, I got an ethics approval and I got consent from the artists to use their real names.
Awesome.
Yep.
Did you only get 12?
I only wanted 12.
Okay.
I mean,
did you get more than 12 and then go, oh, I'll have these 12?
No. No, that was one of the tricky things for me, is working out how much data is enough, and then I learned pretty quickly is you get lots of data.
Yeah.
You know, I think 12, gee, that's not many, but I think in the end I could have worked with 8. Yeah. You know, the data that I got. But what I wanted to do is get a spread of gender, which I did do. I got 6 males and 6 females, which is great. The only thing I didn't get was culturally diverse backgrounds or indigenous backgrounds, which I would have liked to have got, but I suppose that's potentially maybe partly to do with regional Australia, so that wasn't in the mix, so it was some of that. But I also wanted to get a spread from different geographic locations, so that was the key to try and, for want of a better word, to be able to the language that sometimes uses triangulation, other concepts I'll talk about a bit in a minute.
Right.
Yep.
The gatekeepers are cultural workers, so it was like a regional arts Victoria,
yep.
that kind of determines who the mainstream community-based artists are.
Yep.
That's such a term.
Yeah. And look, there's always compromise and there has to be ways in. So I think, over this part of the world, I used Regional Arts Victoria cultural worker. I used the Wangaratta City Council cultural development officer there. On the south coast of New South Wales, I used the New South Wales Regional Arts Development Officer over there. So various contacts either through arts organisations or local government organisations. And again, I declared that in my, when I was declaring how I was going to analyse this, that potentially the tricky one was that who was selected who's going to be clouded by the people who've chosen them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And again, I was going with that. I can't have any control over that. And who am I to say they picked the wrong people?
Yeah.
You know, he's an artist. But again, he's raising all those questions. So it was about going with what I get. And have to work on that.
But that's a lot different than you choosing them all. So
exactly.
Four strangers chose them.
Yep.
Would give the wider diversity perhaps than if you had been thinking about itself.
Yeah, and impartiality, and you know, so that sort of level is I wasn't training this study to be stitched up from the start. These people, in the end, I knew some of them.
I think I know some of them.
Yeah, but I knew some of them. Like, I live in this part of the world here. I think I know three or four. It turns out this young boy here, I actually taught him at school, in a previous life as a school teacher. But I got to him by a different means. I didn't ask to interview him. It was done by a third person. So it legitimises my process of what I'm doing. And that's, again, that key thing with what you're doing when you're going into academia is, you know, if you're relying on the third person, how did you get it? Did you ask your mate? Well, did you get? And you know, how you frame your questions? Did you frame your questions in such a way so that you got the responses you wanted to get? How are you making sure that it is as objective as it can be? Even though I said before, it never will be completely.
It is a very important question that you ask, because in my own experience, cultural workers only know a certain number, mm-hmm. a certain kind of artist who's already engaged in the system mm-hmm. very particularly.
Sure.
And so they will determine.
But also, I suppose, when I'm talking about regional centres here, there's not a great pool out there.
Mm.
Mm.
There's someone working in regional centre, I've actually begged to give up. I actually think there is a different pool as well.
Mm.
And so, I'm doing things in quite a range of different ways.
Sure.
And it's actually quite hard, I think, for some of, say, who actually is engaged with the cultural
work. Of course. Yeah.
So, because they have a prescriptive idea of what constitutes.
Of course. Media. Sure. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But again, like, all I can say is when we come to in the end, there's always trade-offs with your research.
One good question.
Yeah. So yeah, ethically, I was stung there for some time as to how do I make these people anonymous and keep confidentiality going. Where yes, I can give them pseudonyms and whatever else, but depending on what they disclose, or at this point when I was going to interview them, I had included that I might take photos of their work, of them, to assist me in putting it together. And if the images were going to work, I might actually include them in my thesis.
Why is it important for it to be confidential?
Well, sometimes it can be, depending on what the topic is.
But for this,
it wasn't necessarily confidential, okay?
Yeah.
But it can be one of those ethical issues that can be go to ethics committees. It's around how are you protecting the participants so that they won't be recognised. Because it's got occasions people.
So there's certain questions you thought might be.
There might be. Like, yeah. Again, it's always a hard one to know when you're going to ask questions. You don't know what you're going to get.
Yeah.
And, you know, well, how did you come to a community arts based practice? Is why I came, is it because I was, you know, it could be something really psychologically deep.
Going back to the fact that you have cultural workers directing the student. If they're something like human aging, the impact on the relationship.
Yep. Small communities.
But I can still figure out who they are.
Sure, yeah. But no, that's what I'm saying. I could have put, you know, Joe, Mary, Fred, whatever else, and given complex pseudonyms. I actually took the line of, with my ethics application and with the consent form, saying is, I will be sensitive to the issues, but I can't assure you of confidentiality. And
But it's the skill of the writing, and as well, and you would know because you've been in the interview if it was kind of touchy or if it potentially damaging. And you know, the skill of the writing to be able to present that information, but in such a way that it's less likely to have repercussions.
Sure. And the other thing that I did. Everyone. The other thing I actually did was. So with transcripts, I actually sent transcripts back to the participant and asked them. So again, the notion, once the transcript is written, to go through and actually say to them if there's anything in this transcript you don't want disclosed. put it in, highlighted in red, and that's the bits I don't include. So there was again that mechanism to ensure what they had said is clear. But again,
how many people took that out?
Look, not many. There was a couple of bits and pieces where they used a person they were working with. They wanted their name just changed to be a fictitious name. You know, and when I worked in that group, and it was, you know, the local shopkeeper, they'd used their name. They needed that name changed. So it was more of that sort of thing.
Exactly.
And it's also, like, for your own self, it's morally that you need to actually do that. These people are real. I suppose it comes from my view about my. I suppose I'll go back to the next line, probably after that. I did have a semi structured interview which allowed me to. I did have a series of prompts that I would start an interview with and keep me on track, but it wasn't regular. It wasn't. It's like an interview with, tell me question one, give me the answer to this, question two, give me the answer to this. It was more like a conversational style that allowed me to tick things off and say, yes, I've covered that, and wander back all over the place. So it was much more interesting.
I would say, you've got all English-speaking people here.
Yeah.
When it comes to people from coal communities or indigenous people, when you start talking about, you know, disclosure and things like that, and that transcription, particularly on those things, that is just, you know, we just can't just go, oh, well, you know, who's going to read it? Because that is just impossible.
Yeah.
It just will not work.
Yeah.
So you have the simplicity of English-speaking people who can read the English as well. So I just wanted to acknowledge that if you're working with coal communities or indigenous communities, then, you know, disclosing personal
things
about why you became an artist, you know, very, very significant.
Yeah, and it comes back to the perception, I suppose, with the next slide, talking about my methodology, which I've talked a little bit about. Probably these slides are in its own way, but my methodology, I suppose, it's, I talked about a hierarchy of conceptualization, which is those things, but I'll come and show you again another diagram. But again, that concept of naming paradigms, and I'm not sure, coming from an educational perspective, it's quite a big issue of naming your paradigm or your worldview. From your perspective, where the schools you're studying in, is that a crucial thing with you in relation to the research that you're undertaking? Knowing that up pretty early and honestly, so who you are and where you come from, this, and you're in the research, and how you're going to affect that. Mm-hmm. So I came from that constructivist, interpretivist approach.
Because I've struggled with it a lot, and because my work deals with representation and how people represent themselves or how others represent them, I'm really concerned in that potential for self-determination. And if I credit a book as knowledge, I want to credit your voice as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that contribution to knowledge is just as important. It's just a different form of content. So I'm trying to figure out how to actually have these voices valued as much or more than some of the theoretical pieces or contributing to the theories that I'm developing. So I think it's very much about the methodology and your approach to knowledge.
The next structure is, you know, using hermeneutics. And epistemology and ontology. I hate it all. What's that?
That
phenomenology and narrative research approaches. So, you know, and I used, again, qualitative in my approaches were, because they were the most appropriate, were qualitative in nature, and I used inductive spiraling analysis approaches that were themed. The way I came up with this was, again, to help me, was a little chart to work out my sort of, I'll go to the top. I'm actually saying my paradigm leads everything I do in this research. From the very minute I've decided to actually do the study and read the book that I read, I am geared by my blinkers and how I view the world and where I see the world, and working from that premise that other people will see it differently. Then my research design, identifying that there are multiple ways of gathering data, and methods, whether they're qualitative, quantitative, or mixed, but from my study, the qualitative approach, 12 people was enough, and there's going to be a rich source of data there. I wasn't trying to do a broad thing of getting lots of data from various people. A strategy of inquiry using those phenomenological approaches that are based in ethno-methodological and hermeneutic phenomenological streams. this is the section where it does do your head in a bit. Then I started thinking about that notion of data collection, how I would collect my data using in-depth interviews, but also having field notes alongside that, so I ran a diary as I went. Imagery, which I'll talk a bit in a minute, I started to make some imagery myself. I started to make some images. And using text-based literature, it led to this data analysis using these approaches, but this became a two-way process. It wasn't a nice linear process like gathering the data, analysing it and interpreting it. It was very much a spiralling sort of approach where I'd come back and whatever else, because inevitably, you know, you think you've done all your literature, your review is really fun, and then you interview someone and they raise something that you haven't covered in your literature review. How'd you ever? So you have to go back to the literature and deal with that. And using the concept, and then presenting that findings, which my findings, which I wanted to do in a narrative as best I could, ensuring that there were multiple voices there. So, and again, I suppose I was working from everyone, probably, most people working with qualitative methods. So I'm sure you're all aware of Goober and Lincoln and Merton's notion of using the post-positivist criteria to judge writing rather than the constructivist view, sorry. But we're on about dependable, credible, transferable, confirmable and authentic research rather than positivist views that goes on, keep going banging on about reliability, validity and objectivity. And this was a really crucial thing for me to go is, you know, again, from the post-positivist perspective, who want to say, well, you know, how objective is this and how reliable, and saying, well, sorry, you're using the wrong criteria for my work. You're looking at a scientific thesis. My thesis comes from this way of thinking, and I'm doing, and this is the thing that I'm making sure my thesis will be marked on.
Does that disaffirm in one interview is actually the most interesting.
Oh, exactly.
Exactly. That's the key.
Yeah, exactly.
What was
Okay, and then if anyone wants a copy of this presentation, I've got my card. I can give you my card and I'll put you at the center. Sorry, I should have said that. I'm so sorry. I'll do that. I'm sorry.
About how far through the process did you sort of nail?
My methodology, because I did an EdD, and as I said, there were two coursework subjects. So my first coursework subject was, I was meant to audit a subject that was offered. There was no subjects that really on offer that fitted with my study, so I negotiated a reading subject. So I did I had to write a 15,000 word paper, and literally that was looking at those concepts about the art. It's almost starting my lit review. I first attempted my lit review. So my second subject was research methods in education, and I had to write a 15,000 word research proposal. So I had to understand all what I was doing, initially write my methodology. Well, no, it changed so much when I put it into my thesis. because my proposal was what I was going to do, my methodology chapter of what I did, or part of it, or what I intended to do, but it changed as I was in there as well. So it gave me a structure, really. And so I had a good year or 12 months just focusing on my methodology. And before I started collecting my data. Okay, now this is some key stuff for me that allowed me to keep make sense of what I was doing along the journey. And one of them was coming up, discovering that term really early, bricoleur. Has anyone come up with that term with Denzin and Lincoln and Levi Strauss? But, bricoleur, it's a French term. I remember driving around Paris, France last year, and there's signs everywhere, Mr. Bricoleur. Bricolage in France, French is handyman, a bricoleur is a handyman, a handy person, and so the concept of Denzin and Lincoln is, Levi Strauss refers to a bricoleur in an academic sense as a kind of professional, an intellectual handyman, a kind of professional do-it-yourself person. And Denzin and Lincoln use it to describe a description of a bricoleur and their metaphor of a quilt maker being someone who combines a range of potentially disparate sets of representations, images, ideas and fits them to the specifics of a complex situation. And for me that went, this is liberating. This is saying I don't have to follow this path purely. I can take this bit and put it together and make something for me. So that was a key concept that allowed me to go, I don't have to view this through a very narrow prism, what I'm doing. The next one was the concept of rhythmatics. It came from Deleuze and Guattari, which talk, and I'll use some of their quotes because they're good.
Is that anti-Oedipus? Hmm? Was it anti-Oedipus?
No, this one's about the Thousand Plateau.
Oh, okay.
Yep. It talks about rhythmatics, that unlike trees or their roots, the rhizome connects any point to any point, and its traits are not necessarily linked to traits of the same nature. It is neither a beginning nor an end, but always in the middle, from which it will grow. It has multiple entryways and exits, and its own lines of flight. So again, for me, that would be seeming like this notion of it continues and I can go here. I really like that sort of thing about thinking about how it's all underground, the rhizome just pops up here and pops up there rather than that tree metaphor. It became another concept for me to make sense. The concept of reflexivity, reflexive bracketing and reflexive questions were really crucial for me, and I had this blown up quite large on my wall and I would refer to it lots, and it came out of Patton's work. And it was around saying these questions that I would ask is to, that I will have various lenses that I'm looking at through this study, my race, my culture, my education and whatever else. And the people that I'm studying, how do they know what they know? What shapes their views? I kept thinking about that in relation to what I was doing. Those who the study is for, again, I got into my head really early, this is a PhD or it's a thesis that, you know, in the end, it's the three people who mark this, that's the most important thing this is for. They've got to read it. The PhD, your journal articles come out of it later on. This has got to be written for three people to read. So it's got to be, you've got to keep thinking about the audience, and the audience for your thesis is the examiners, no one else.
Did you know your examiners?
No.
But they were education.
Yeah. I've got a chance to identify some people who might examine towards the end, but yeah. And then myself, what do I know? Again, so talking about me coming to this research, I'm in the research, what do I know? What shapes my views? When I'm making these assumptions, how do I do that? So it became a really useful thing to going, okay, is this my view in this? How does that relate to people I'm working with? And allowed me to continually think, try and be as conscious of me being it as possible. No. Okay. Next thing, the orthography notion that was mentioned there before, and Richardson's work of writing as a creative analytical process. Has anyone come across Laurel Richardson's work? She's a wonderful American woman, and she talks about writing as a process. The writing process and the writing product are deeply intertwined. Both are privileged. The product cannot be separated from the producer, the mode of production, or the method of writing. So she continually talks about that writing is the way you actually come to your thoughts, and that's where I came back to. I remember a really good bit of advice I got from the start was write early and write lots. and keep that writing somewhere that you'll come back to. So, like the concept I would argue, Kim, I wouldn't write up my thesis. I was writing as I was collecting data along the way. It's all happened together. It's not just a single process. These are some of the images that emerged for me. I just wanted to go a separate tangent here. These became a series of plateaus for me that represented my thoughts and feelings through the process.
Sculptures,
they stand about this high. They were based on my thoughts of the landscapes that I was driving through and the little thoughts that I had in relation to how people's ideas were making sense. So they were, they appeared.
Are they carved out of wood?
They're constructed out of wood. And look, some people say it's an avoidance strategy. These appeared, there was a six month period where I became paralysed with the dark. I didn't know what to do. So at my place, there was a little place where I could work, a little building where I could work, or my studio was there. I'd walk out of my house every morning and go, do I go there and analyse the data? Do I go to the shed and play? Go to the shed and play. And it was about a 6 month process, but I was making these, and I know in the process when I was making them, there's some unconscious learning going on for me because they related to it. And I'll come back to these again, but that's where, again, I was going to take that safe path. This came. I don't know how, and I kept my supervisor, finished up actually putting these images into my thesis to talk about it as part of my reflexive process. So in the end there was 40 odd of those that came to be. Okay, the findings, quickly, blah blah. This is again with my how I could try and put my findings together. Initially, I came up with a list, you know, so theme one, sub theme, and this, I think it looks so linear, and it's actually suggesting that one might be the important one. No, it's not like that. And I came up with the concept to talk about my themes as tracks and trails. And if we go back to the Looney cartoon, taking the dirty, dark and dirty track, I started to weave Looney's terms into this came later in. So I talked about these were the tracks. So there were four, five, six major sub-themes, communities we work in and circulating, the impact of place on what we do, our ways of working, why we do this work, what we acquire from the work and the roles we perform. They were the major tracks or the major themes, and then out of those there's a series of sub-themes. I used this Lotus chart because it actually allowed me to say that, and when I had them listed linearly, it was sort of saying, well, but they're linked. And this actually allowed me to say, this one is sort of linked close to this and this. So it became a nice interactive way of actually looking. And it actually allowed me to put my theoretical framework around the outside, saying, this one sort of links to the concept of identity that I was looking at in the literature review. So it became a structure for me to work inside.
So the size of the boxes represent...
No, it's the text to fit in. The colour scheme was the way I went about the colour scheme and different fonts was the way I sort of analysed my data. I'd read a manuscript, and I would go through and I started to develop up colour codes. So when I read Mary's manuscript and the impact on what we do, I would highlight text in green. So when I went back and read a manuscript, if I was looking for things about the impact of what we do, I had to go back and read manuscripts, I could skim and scan for greens. And it made it really easy for me to find all the greens and put them together. So the colour codes, and each of these, and then I started to think about, okay, having or gaining trust and respect and credibility, by having that font and that colour in everyone's transcripts, I could go through and find those and put them all together. So it was a way of grouping for me. It made sense for me.
And that's the dotted line?
Pardon? The dotted line is because I couldn't work out the difference between the impact of place on what we do and communities we work and live and circulate in. It became a grey, this sort of almost like became one big box in itself. Mm-hmm. Okay?
I want to ask about your colour coding.
Yep.
Did you use any of the quantity software?
No.
Kind of stuff?
No. No. I just decided that would give me repetition of words and whatever else, but I was looking for meanings, I think, and you're not going to get them. And, you know, 12, I thought about it, and I thought, for 12 interviews, I was going to sit down and wallow in them and play with them, rather than in vivo or all those other things. So I presented in each of my chapters, or my findings, this I would take the little section, which I think is that one, And that would begin, that would start at that findings chapter, one quote. I'll just put there, but the key things there, a lot of them talked about knowing that they wanted to be artists from a long time previously. A lot of them had the art making skills, working to a community, going to community based settings. They didn't lack. They had real anxieties about how they'd work with groups, and they had to learn those skills on their own. Most times, trial by fire, but they got through them. They had support at various times in their lives where they would move from being artists or enjoying art to then having real jobs and then coming back to art at some later stage. Having been in the right time and place, that sort of circumstances allowed them to move into the art world, because maybe kids had moved on and they didn't have to worry about an income so much, or that their perspectives had changed. Most of them had been exhibiting in galleries and were sick of the art world a bit. Why they did the work? Initially, a lot of them went into it because they saw it as money, as a way to supplement their income. They soon realised that the money they earned on the projects was minimal, which was an interesting process for me. One of the things that did come from this is that notion of where they moved from unconscious or their tacit knowing to be able to discursively say that. A lot of them said, "I haven't ever thought about why I do this work before. You're making me think about something that I never thought about before. I've just done it." And that was an interesting process in themselves, that they'd never thought about, why do I do this? So for them, it was those sorts of processes. So they moved from things of seeing it as financial gain to they start to actually could maintain that most of them did have it come from a philosophical bent about social justice that they hadn't really thought about before. They also talked about they could challenge the ideas of being an artist in the community, because a lot of them working in smaller communities they would live in, potentially their artwork was not necessarily perceived, the artwork they made was not necessarily accessible to the community, their studio work they made, but this work allowed them to connect. Similar sort, similarly how artists, we want participants to connect, these artists were connecting to their community, because they were potentially sometimes seen as the rat bag or the lunatic on the outside, and that's how they didn't see themselves, but these community processes allowed them to, for people to see them for who they were. What else? The roles they performed, they performed numerous roles from the business life. They talked about the level of distrust that would happen with bureaucratic organisations and the level of accountability they would have to go under as far as acquittal of whatever else, and the bureaucratisation and the governmentality notions of how community-based arts had come about, and they were sort of a small wheel in the cog. Again, sort of teaching, but anything but teaching. One of the things I talked about a bit outside is the artists would use every label under the sun to describe what they do, and they talked about teaching, but they would never use the word teacher. And even the artists who had been trained as teachers, they talked about, I don't do those things that teachers do. It's a different environment, and they talked about that reason that they didn't have to write reports, they didn't have to worry about discipline, they didn't have to worry about a whole lot of other stuff that was part of a teacher's world. And what they acquired, which was the key thing I was on about really, is by them working with others allowed them to see them in different ways, and they could see themselves in different ways. They could go beyond the superficial level in communities and go much deeper with people and about themselves. It was heavily based on their interaction with people. They wanted to work with others because of that social isolation that can happen. It shaped and informed their practice a little bit, but they didn't talk much about that. And the other thing they really liked was the powerful stuff that they saw the changes happen. They could see, these people have gained skills and qualities. Okay, I talked about some of those findings. I do want to go somewhere else, sorry. I'll just go here. Out of this work, there's another body of work came, and it was the Capriccios, and this is a body of work that I produced as when I submitted my assignment, or submitted my thesis. This work came as a, I'm seeing it as a bit of a purge for me. It came between submitting my thesis and getting my mark back, that 3 months wait that you wait. And these are a series of fake bronze works. This one, I'll go through these quickly. Fake bronze, yeah. This one was called At the End of the Day, and a lot of people interpreted that I was after the gold chalice, but really at the end of the day it was going for a glass of red wine. This one was called Does Anybody Notice When the Wheel Falls Off? And again, thinking about that loony cartoon that I talked with the card at the start, these sorts of images come into place. For me, this one was called Draft, 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 Draft. This one was called Near Miss or Epiphany. That one was titled I Don't Know Anymore. That one was called I Had It and I Lost It. Into the Abyss. climbing to a higher plane. This one was called In Search of a Rhizome. The Beast at the Gate.
What's this?
The goalpost. Someone keeps moving the goalpost. That one was The Literature Says. Climbing the Wrong Groovy Pole. Thinking About My Pants On. Tired of the Wise One. And this culminated in a body of exhibition at the start of this year, which that was the work in the show, which this didn't count towards my thesis, but it was a parallel process that came about. So I'm going to stop there. The end. Oh, and then I suppose the little figure that came along is the end. Look, I suppose the one other thing I did want to finish on is bringing, I just talked about that, bringing the study to a close and reflecting on our experience in relation to the text in Lenny's cartoon. From most of the artists, I heard a range of ideas about the world of art. In one sense, they had crossed the borders from the solely being involved in conventional art world to broader forms of art practices. In doing so, some had rejected the art world completely. Others, while being involved in community-based arts practices, also maintained links with the art world, and others were not able to differentiate between worlds. Regardless of the track they had taken, they had all an inherent need to be involved in art making, which underpinned and guided what they and how they lived. They all displayed the qualities of Throsby and Holster, argued that music is the heart of professional art. Although a small number of artists in this study have also demonstrated that the art world a decade on from when Lunick's cartoon was published has shifted and expanded and hybridised, we are living in a time where community arts is a site of possibilities. If we view the goodies that artists have in their cart as both tangible and intangible resources, sources that Coty and Levine refer to as identity capital, the goodies the artists in this study possess have not remained static. Their respective carts have required a continual repacking. The tracks these artists have taken were perhaps at times dark and dirty, being full of uncertainties, although they have provided them with expanded insights and broad range of experiences. So I came back, finished my thesis with this as becoming a complete entity in itself.
Our time's up, Mark. So what we'll do now is we'll finish the session, but we'll if there are people who'd like to discuss things with Mark or with each other, feel free to do that while we finish up in the room. What I'm thinking to do is save Mark having everyone email him. I'll negotiate with you what you would be prepared to share, and then I'll share that with everyone. And I thought we were having a non-verbal discussion about is it all right for me to take the session when it's not that I was showing him that I've got a pointer for the thing. But anyway, I'll take the session.
Okay.
Yep. I hope that's all right with you, Mark.
We'll just see your ethics application.
So that's all the beginning that I've negotiated successfully with Mark. That'll be on our website as well. So.
And look, what I'll do is rather than